Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The magnitude of China's urban migration is hard to fathom when you hear the numbers. In the past 30 years, the country's urban population has more than doubled. Last year, more than 270 million peasants who were registered to live in the countryside were working in urban areas. They left their families and farmlands behind in search for a better life in China's cities. Over the next 30 years, the urban population is expected to double once again, reaching 1 billion. Imagine this. In about a dozen years, China will have 220 cities with populations above 1 million. 15 super cities will each have more than 225 million residents. The entire state of Texas has 25 million people. These are the numbers that journalist Michelle Damon Loyalka starts off in her new book, Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. Michelle, our guest in the Global Journalist Studio, also points out that these millions and millions of migrants provide the profusion of cheap labor that helps fuel China's staggering economic growth. Welcome to the program, and welcome back to your alma mater.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And also, Michelle brings the problems associated with this gigantic transformation and the global impact down to the street level, the personal level. Eating Bitterness chronicles the lives of 8 migrants, and in the process illustrates the entire country's complicated character and problematic growth. Also joining us by telephone on this program to talk about China's urban migration is Mark Frazier. Mark is an endowed professor of Chinese politics at the University of Oklahoma and chair of the International Studies Department. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
So let me ask each of you to briefly outline a few of the key problems that China faces in dealing with this pressing domestic challenge, how to accommodate hyperspeed development. Michelle, you want to start out?
Sure. First of all, Chinese migrants, when they come to the cities, they tend to snap up sort of the lowest level jobs, the dirty and distasteful jobs that urbanites aren't really interested in. And they work really long hours. So we're talking about 80% of migrants work 7 days a week, 10 to 13 or more hours a day, and often 360 or more days a year.
Wow.
So that's a really significant problem. Also, their living conditions. So some places provide them with dormitories, but otherwise they have to essentially live in these migrant enclaves on the outskirts of society, which are essentially old farming villages where the farmland has been bought up, but the cluster of village homes remains. And so they, I think it's also about 70% of migrants live in 8 square meters or less. So we're talking about essentially a bed with a little walkway around it. So then there's also a whole host of social problems that they faced. I mean, there's definitely social stigma. Urbanites find them to be stereotypically to be of lower quality than urbanites. And their children often, you know, if they go to schools, if they're able to go to schools in the city, the children often also, they can't keep up with the pace of the schooling in the urban areas. And they're kind of ostracized from their peers. So there's a whole host of problems that migrants face. Then there's also this whole issue of hukou or household registration system that we're hearing a lot about in the news these days, and probably Mark would be better to talk about that than me.
Mark, you want to take up that aspect of this problem?
Sure. The household registration system, or hukou in Chinese, it is many decades old, and we can talk about the history of it if anyone's interested, but of how it came about. But the main problem now is that you have, as Michelle noted, this incredibly rapid urbanization going on in China, where just even last year in 2011, the 1.3 billion population of China is now officially over 51% urbanized, or that is to say half the population is now living in urban areas. But because of the household registration system, about 200 million of that 650 or 700 million people living in urban areas, so a huge chunk of them, possess a registration status that basically says they are peasants. And this means that in the cities and in the living spaces that Michelle just described, they and their children have virtually no access to ordinary public services like schools, public health clinics, hospitals, et cetera, that urban residents do. And so this creates a two-tier level of citizenship, basically. And it is a very hot and controversial political topic. Many Chinese, many informed Chinese, are wondering why we still have this system that treats people who come from the countryside as second-class citizens.
Now, besides the two-tiered system, how is China's situation different than, say, America's past urbanization or India's current mega-growth?
Well, in any country that's urbanizing, and many, of course, have urbanized in history, there is a common theme, which is moving from rural areas to urban areas, people that is, and then, of course, in terms of your economy, you go from being predominantly farming and agricultural to industrial and working class formation that happens. What's different, though, if you talk about the U.S. or India, is that essentially the migration in many other countries besides just the U.S. and India, the immigration has been relatively voluntary. It doesn't mean that they're coming from one great place in the rural areas to an even better place in the cities. It is always difficult. They always face discrimination. But generally speaking, there hasn't been this legal administrative classification, this basically internal passport system that one sees in the Chinese case. It would be as if in the 1930s and 40s, when we had the massive migration out of the South by African Americans to industrial centers in the Midwest, Chicago, Detroit, so forth, that if they got to Detroit and Chicago and they were told that you can't have any access, your children can't go to schools here, you can't have access to public housing or to public hospitals, et cetera. Not to say that they didn't.
That's what I was going to say, that they didn't. Essentially, they were.
But it wasn't as though there was a U.S. law,
right,
which would legally permit them to not have access to those things.
Right. We'll get back into some of the general problems in more detail, but let's get back to Michelle's book and then build up to the China's growth management. So you lived in China for 13 years,
right,
and with a break to get your master's degree in journalism here, and you spent long hours in a remote farming region and in a booming new high-tech zone. So tell us about how that experience led to this book.
Well, actually, the very foundational experience that led me to write this book was I had the opportunity to live in a banana farming village in southern China. This was back in 1999. And just the pace of life, the kind of values people held, the things that they were thinking about were so different than what I had experienced in urban China. And that experience really got me thinking about China's economic recovery from the point of view of the peasant population. And from there, then I moved into Xi'an in western China and into this high-tech zone, which was really growing extremely quickly. And from the window of my apartment, actually, I could see, any given time there'd be 10 to 20 cranes out on the horizon building up new urban high-rises. Mm-hmm. But what I could also see from my window was this old village called Ganjiajai, which was essentially a farming village whose land had been bought up to make way for the high-tech zone. But the village house has remained, and that village originally held about 1,500 farmers, and at that time it was now packed with 30,000 rural migrants in about a five-block area. Wow. And so I could only imagine. I mean, the development in Xi'an was so fast that sometimes I felt a bit dizzy. Just you didn't know from month to month and year to year what was going to be happening there. So I could only imagine how people who came fresh out of the countryside to these areas, how they were feeling. And so when I started to write the book, right around that time, this village of Ganjajai was about to be demolished to make way for a more high-tech zone development. And all of the people that I interacted with regularly, whether it was the people I bought vegetables from or security guards, people who worked in restaurants, hairdressers, everybody was really anxious about this because they worked in this high-tech area, but they didn't really have a place in the high-tech zone. They lived in this old village of Ganjajai. And once that was torn down, they really didn't know how could they support their life in urban China anymore, because they certainly couldn't afford to sort of integrate into an area like the high-tech zone. So that's when it really clicked for me that, you know, these migrants are so essential to building up every aspect of China's own domestic life, and yet they are really outsiders in a lot of ways and not really ever able to fully integrate into urban life.
And what are some of the reasons you picked these particular people? And kind of describe a few of the professions or a few of the occupations that they held.
Sure. I knew I wanted to choose a mix of migrants that would sort of represent different professions, different life experiences, different ages, different genders. And I wanted to sort of, through these different profiles together, kind of give a picture of what it's like to embark on the migrant experience in China. And so I had a few categories in mind, you know, a few age groups. For example, oftentimes in Xi'an at that time, you would see an older man doing some sort of small-time entrepreneurial work from the back of a bicycle. That's really common. So I knew I wanted somebody who was in that category. Besides that, I kind of was open and just explored the neighborhood, and also some of the people I had known previously. So, for example, there's a chapter of people who sell vegetables in the local outdoor vegetable market. Mm-hmm. I had bought my vegetables from them for several years before I ever started the book
project. It's a real intimate portrait of that couple.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think I was really lucky because in China, it seems that when you start talking to people, almost everybody has some sort of amazing life story. I mean, the recent history is such that people's lives have been full of adversity and also triumph. And so it seemed like when you start to talk with people and really kind of get into the details of their life, anybody would actually make a really good subject to profile. Well,
the one theme that goes through it is the eating bitterness, the title of your book. Could you explain that?
Sure. So in Chinese, there's this great word, which is churku. And that essentially means to endure difficulties, to persevere, and to sort of press forward all in one without really kind of complaining or, you know, stopping to think about is this what I want to be doing? Just kind of this brute force moving ahead at all costs sort of mentality. And, you know, so we don't have that kind of one word in English that sums all of that up. But if we translate it directly, it comes out to eating bitterness. Mm-hmm. And I didn't start off with this as a theme in the book, but as I talked with people, mm-hmm. Over and over, they kind of themselves brought this up as one of the keys that they saw to being their ability to survive in the city all this time. And, you know, the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, this ability is actually very key to China's own ability to move ahead so quickly over the last several mm-hmm. decades, because it can rely on a workforce who really just
sucks it up.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to say it.
You mentioned in an interview that if you had to choose a favorite character in the book, it would probably be the last chapter, the big boss.
Yes.
Tell us about him and why you think that illustrates the future of China.
Sure. So that's a chapter of a 32-year-old who was a second grade dropout and a runaway, and he had moved to Xi'an about 5 years before I started to talk with him. And in those 5 years, he essentially built up, he went from being essentially destitute to having built up an entire empire of convenience stores. And so he became extremely successful. But although he'd sort of blown past all the obstacles that would typically be in a migrant's path, he feels more lonely and isolated than he ever did when he was poor. And he really has this desire to turn his sight away from just his self and do some sort of philanthropy. But nobody around him can really understand those desires. So to me, this represents the direction that modern China is headed because, you know, when reform started, people sort of had this mentality that we have to develop materially first. And mm-hmm. anything besides making material progress was sort of seen as a distraction. And so, you know, but now the economy has grown so much in those years that people are starting to really attain their material dreams, surpass the dreams they originally started with. And so a real kind of restlessness is setting in. People are starting to wonder, now what? You know, what's the next step?
Right.
And I certainly don't think that most migrants will become as successful as this man will, or even most urbanites won't become that successful. But, you know, the GDP in China is growing so fast that it doubles every 7 years. So everybody's life is getting better, not across the board evenly, but everyone's standard of living is improving. And so I think at some point, these migrants will stop and sort of reassess this, right. this mentality they've had to just eat bitterness for so long. And when they do that, I mean, it's going to be a real challenge to China.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to bring Mark back in. And Mark, and Michelle, you can also get into this. I want to talk about some of the current strains on the Chinese economy. After the holiday break this year, for example, China experienced a shortage of workers because some of them failed to return to work after the holiday, and there have been strikes by workers demanding higher wages and better working conditions. Mark, can you talk about these labor issues that may be getting more intense?
Sure. Well, one of the things that is so fascinating about some of the recent labor protests, most visibly the one in 2010 at some automobile assembly factories, actually automobile supplier parts managed by Honda, was that these were migrant workers, but definitely the second generation, or those born in, say, the decade of the 1980s, who have a very different kind of identity, as you might expect, from those of their migrant worker parents, who probably tell their children who are going off to work for a Japanese automobile manufacturer like Honda that, you know, I've eaten bitterness, to use Michelle's term that from her book. I've worked hard. Now, you go and work as hard as I did, but the children who you know, are going to be different from their parents, have a very different attitude, and they expect to have better wages, better benefits, fewer working hours, not having to endure the kinds of dormitory living conditions that their parents did. And so we're seeing this generational change that's translating into much you know, stronger demands for better working conditions by that second generation of the migrant labor force. But at the same time, politically, we're seeing a Communist Party leadership that is trying to reach out to the impoverished population, the migrant workers, the ordinary people. You hear this in speeches all the time. And so they're in a very difficult place where they need to be seen as supporting the strikes, not repressing them. But also not scaring off foreign investors for whom, you know, capital is so important, has been so important in China's economic takeoff.
Right. And I saw that on March 5th that the premier told the People's Congress that migrant workers will become, quote, permanent urban residents in an orderly manner. So it sounds like the government is somewhat addressing this registration process and the lifestyle. Do you think that they really are going to take some of these actions? First Mark and then Michelle?
Yes. I mean, yes, the premier said that, and this is kind of as it might be analogized to a State of the Union address where the premier, among a laundry list of things, talks about the issues that the party and government will address in the coming year. And the key phrase there is at the end, in an orderly fashion, which means basically someday, gradually and not suddenly. They do still worry about, the argument is that if we were to just get rid of the hukou system, we would face this onslaught of migrant workers and our cities wouldn't be able to handle. There's an argument against that, which is that, well, that's already happened, basically. But at any rate, that's the political the policy position by those who are opposed to completely abolishing the hukou system.
And Michelle?
Well, I think it's interesting because one thing that we don't hear too much about in the West, at least, is that this hukou system is also linked with land. So
yeah.
In China, when you're categorized as a rural resident, you receive a parcel of land essentially at birth. Now, it's not, you don't own it, you can't sell it, and if you let it go fallow, you'll lose it. But and when you die, it goes back to the village to be redistributed to the next generation. But essentially, every person has a parcel of land. It's a very small parcel of land. It's only about a sixth of an acre, so it's not really a viable means of livelihood, which is why we see so many people leaving the countryside and going to the cities to look for work. But this land, you can't underestimate how important that is to rural people. It's definitely a sustenance insurance plan. And a lot of the migrants that I talked to said that they wouldn't be willing to give up their hukou, their rural
right.
hukou for urban hukou, because they feel like, as unskilled laborers, someday in the cities, they really, when they get older, when their bodies break down and they're not able to just kind of do physical
yeah.
labor, what place will they have in the city? So they want to keep that parcel of land associated with their urban or with their rural registration as a sustenance insurance plan and as a fallback option. And most people said, once in China, once you're a farmer, you're always a farmer. So I had counted a lot of people who weren't really willing to switch. And I think they've found that. They've had some pilot programs in the South and in some places in the West where they offered people to be able to switch the residency. And in fact, a lot of people, they didn't have a lot of takers. So I think
wow.
that's also another issue that is kind of tricky for the government to tackle.
Yeah, and if I could add to that, of course, the coercive side of that comes in when, rather than you going to the city as a migrant worker and toiling away and then going back to your land, sometimes if you're a peasant who lives on the outer belt around one of these rapidly growing cities, it's the other way around. The city comes to you. And whether you want to keep your parcel of land or not, oftentimes the city officials, using the police power and other coercive capabilities they have, will compel you to sell your land and in exchange give you some public housing, hopefully. But the point being that once your land is in their hands, they turn it over to a real estate developer who will build a high-tech zone of the kind Michelle mentioned, or a shopping center, something like this, a high rise. And so this has been a cause of many riots and protests of various sorts to confront these officials who are essentially engaging in land grabbing.
Right. Let's move to healthcare. And I know that's also part of this two-tiered system. And several of the people you profiled in America, we talk about being medical emergency away from bankruptcy, and particularly the vegetable vendors. He was in debt for years because of a health problem, and these migrants aren't insured as the urban residents are. And then we have the problem of communicable diseases. Can each of you talk about the healthcare issue? Michelle, you want to go first?
Sure. The government is making big strides that sort of extend the coverage of its subsidized health care. And with the hukou also, everyone is entitled to health care, subsidized health care, but only in the place where you're registered. So obviously, as migrant workers, when they leave their villages and they come to the cities, then they're not entitled to those same social services. And so that's a big problem for migrants. The same holds true for schooling, for example. So everyone is entitled to schooling for their children, but again, only in the places where you're registered. So a lot of migrant children have been denied access into urban schools. And this is definitely a problem that they're trying to deal with, but it's definitely slow.
Mark, how do you see the government coping and dealing with this problem?
Well, it's interesting because the government will pull out a chart showing that in the last 5 years, the number of people with health insurance coverage has gone from something like 300 million, basically those who had been who are in cities, to now maybe 900 million or even 1 billion, getting close to 100% of the population. And this is simply by a trick in which the government is registering both urban and rural people, and of course migrant workers too, under highly localized, highly fragmented health insurance plans. And they pay a little bit of a premium. They get health insurance coverage, but as some of Michelle's informants in the book talk about, you are still very subject, vulnerable to the huge hospital bill. That even though you have insurance, it may cover only 10% of what your actual costs are. And this gets into the problem of the fact that hospitals and clinics in China have essentially gone private, fee-for-service model. So doctors and hospital managers are completely incentivized to test as much as possible in order to charge as much as possible in order to earn as much profit. And you get into a mess of the sort we're familiar with here in the U.S.
Right. And before we wrap up our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or at our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. Now, just for the last question, I want to talk about the factories. In America, the biggest story related to the Chinese workforce is the poor working conditions at factories making components for Apple products, particularly Foxconn.
Right.
How big a role do factories play in this migration dilemma, Michelle?
Well, from what we'd see in the West and Western media, I think people think that most migrants are factory workers. But in fact, of the 200 and some million migrant workers, less than a third of them work in factories. So most of them are doing some other sort of work in the cities. And I think one of the things that I didn't follow any factory workers in my book because I feel that they're kind of isolated from society in a lot of ways. They live in, compounds in the factories. But one of the things with all of that coverage about Foxconn, I often saw people talk about it, the conditions as being like slave labor. But I didn't really think that that was a fair portrayal because the migrants that I interviewed who are self-employed, they choose to live in very similar ways. So, the vegetable vendors in my book, they work every day from 3 a.m. to 9 p.m. So we're talking about, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, 360 days a year. And they live in essentially a one-car garage with their daughter without plumbing or heat or even a window. And you would think that they're doing this because they're just totally destitute. But in fact, that's not the case. In China, the savings rate is nearly 40%. But among migrants, I think they try to get about as close to 100% as possible. So people will live in very hard conditions, not because they don't have another means, but because they want to save all the money they can.
And the one-child policy, they're sort of living for that child as well.
Absolutely, for the next generation.
Well, we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Mark Frazier, professor of Chinese politics at the University of Oklahoma, and Michelle Loyalka, author of Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. Thank you both for joining us today. It's a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And a growing problem. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer, with assistance from Ryan Kress. Please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.